so what page are we on? Behind the group there stands the door before them opens out the way. It's going to be page 41 in the rays and the initiations, page 41. And we have with us, Elena has joined us, Andrew, Elena, Daniel, Johanna, Lynn, Mauricio, and Micheline. Hi, Micheline. Welcome. I think from Canada, I think. And welcome all. So we are continuing on our fourth day to discuss Rule 1. And there's only 13 rules to go. We have to figure whether that's going to be a project for this incarnation or not. You know, he said that the last seven rules are, well, they're pretty much for initiates only. But then I kind of wonder, what about the first seven? You know, seems like the first seven have also those particular qualities which require the initiate understanding. But he did say yesterday that there is a reflection of these rules which can be appreciated by those people for whom the second degree is more an objective or a recent acquisition. And so they would be of a broader and more general usefulness. So we will trust that we will be warming up now for our third degree appreciation of these rules in some future incarnation. Maybe not long, we'll see. Behind the group there stands the door, before them opens out the way. All right. The way of higher evolution, seven paths at first. First discussed in Initiation Human and Solar, then elaborated in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and then he said he got permission to give even more information when his last book was written, The Rays and the Initiation. So given those three sources, we've learned quite a bit about the great incentive that lies ahead for the liberated monad following the sixth initiation. It used to be that these ways could be approached at the fifth initiation. But then again, the standard was raised, and I suppose an interesting thing, things are so serious on our planet right now that Sanat Kumara has reserved the right to retain all sixth-degree initiates on the planet before releasing them to tread the way of higher evolution. He needs their assistance. They usually function together every 49 years. So if we went back to 1903, they made a certain type of decision, which I think basically opened up the entire atomic revolution for humanity. Then again, they met in 1952, but this was after DK had given had stopped writing with Alice Bailey. She had died in 1949. So we don't know what the nature of that decision was, but we had the communications revolution. So you wonder, you see, the third ray rules initiation number six, Libra and the third ray. And it seems like the great revolution took place in the Department of Intelligence, frankly. The fifth ray was being phased out already by that time, according to a decision by Sanat Kumara, because it was too far in advance of humanity's morality, and simply their human relations were too bad to allow the fifth ray to continue in full force. So we are left with the idea of the third ray at that great decision in 1952. It was also at that time, interestingly enough, that Foster Bailey wrote a book in which he had been, he said, in communication with Master DK, who assured him there would not be an atomic war. That is actually a a fairly cheerful thought, as just a few years before, in the late 40s, DK had written through Alice Bailey some very dire predictions about what could happen in terms of a religious war on this planet. But then Foster Bailey, who was, of course, again, an initiate, and would be taking the same place at Master Moria's ashram as Alice Bailey was taking in KH's ashram, and who therefore, I think, could be in touch with DK, said that the master had assured him that there would not be an atomic war. So, you know, that's one little grain of hope balanced against the dire prognostications that DK gave when he said, you better put all those billions you're putting into armaments, into education, or watch out. And of course, we do see that a fanatical kind of ignorance is now fueling some very serious conflicts on our planet. So we'll see. We have nothing to do but to see how this works out while we are, meanwhile, doing our best. Then the next decision was made in 2001. That was the next 49 years for the next great decision for these retained sixth-degree initiates who are not allowed to go off on their paths yet because Sanat Kumara needs their help. And we don't know. I mean, that was 11 years ago, wasn't it? So we can only, you know, kind of predict what that decision was all about, because when these initiates of the sixth degree make a decision, it is for the welfare of humanity and the planet, and it also always has drastic results. DK basically said that the decision in 1903 precipitated World War I. You know, that benevolent precipitation, or the Great War. You know, obviously it was somehow trying to establish firmer spiritual values on Earth and draw a real line between the old materialistic values and new possibilities. And the so-called Great War from 1914 to 1945 certainly did that. But we don't have DK writing to us right now to tell us what was the nature or quality of the great decision in 1952 or that which was in 2001. But I think there's going to be a tremendous social revolution from 2001 to 2050. And a number of us will be living through that. Maybe we're living through it right now. I think there's going to be a very strong global financial readjustment that may be one of the consequences of this great decision. Anyway, the reason I got on that subject was the idea that before them opens out the way. Well, it does open out the way, but then again, Sanat Kumara has to give you permission to go. And it's a very interesting thing that on the path of Earth service, which is directly under Sanat Kumara's supervision, not many people take that path of Earth service because you have to, in a way, be tapped on the shoulder by the planetary logos to say, we need you specifically for this task. So it's not so much by choice that you choose the path of Earth service, but more by the invitation or even request, I suppose, or even firm insistence by Sanat Kumara that you are needed on this planet. But things, like I say, are so serious now that all of the sixth-degree initiates are needed. And I don't know how many there are, but we have to make this transition. It's not just like a transition into the new age. It's not as simple as that. Those transitions are made every 2100 years. This is a critical, critical moment because a period of 250,000 years has just ended, which we are told represents one time around the Pleiades for our solar system and others. 250,000 years has just ended within the last couple of thousand years, and the age of Pisces, which lasts not 2,000 years, but 25,000 years is also ending, and a new age of Aquarius is beginning. And the planetary soul on the second ray is coming into power, and humanity is getting ready to move a fair share of human beings into the fifth kingdom of nature. So you put all of those things together and a lot more, and this is a time of unusual crisis. As a matter of fact, ever since the hierarchy was established, Shambhala hierarchy, 18.5 million years ago, they have been looking forward to this moment in time, to this moment in planetary history. So it is the most advantageous and yet the most serious moment we've ever had in our planetary history, and this includes the sinking of Atlantis and the volcanic destruction of Lemuria and all of that. This is the moment, and we are living in this. Of course, even if we were to die or whatever and be on the other side of the veil, we're told that the conflict there is even more strenuous. So there's no escape from participation in this particular serious moment of the planet. Yes, any thoughts about that? Complaints? What do they do? You mean on the other side? Well, you know, when some of DK's... it's pretty mundane in a way. It's pretty close to Earth. Some of DK's disciples in his groups had passed over, and he was telling the group that was still here, he said, do not let them out of your medication. Do not let them out of your meditation. They are still right here with us working within the group, and it is only right for you to include them in your meditation. For instance, CDP, this was during the war, okay, they had died. She is working with the children who have been killed in the war, and she is attempting to preserve the integrity of their consciousness. So she's working with children. That's what her job was. Another guy, K.E.S., he's been in the military, and so he is working with members of the military who have died in the war, and he is sort of welcoming them and orienting them. Another man who was a Jesuit priest, he was killed in Belgium somewhere along the line. And DK says that he's working very strenuously in my ashram. And then a couple of years later, he said, now he has gone on to the ashram of his true master, Master Moria. So he stopped describing what he was doing. But this was very interesting. This was a second ray soul. A PDW or PPG, I forget. I remember his rays. His rays were Ray 2 Soul, Ray 6 Personality, Ray 5 Mind, Ray 6 Astral Body, Ray 7 Physical Body. This man was a second ray soul, very strong on the wisdom line, and then DK says he's gone on to be now to work with his true master. So what are the implications? See, he was probably a second-degree initiate. He was very mentally polarized. The implications are, what are the implications for his ray structure? He's a monadic ray one. See, so DK doesn't talk about the monadic rays too much with his, you know, about his students, but every once in a while he drops a big hint, and that was a really big hint. So he's probably given the monadic ray of about four or five, maybe six of his students through these kinds of hints. And about two people, he is entirely explicit. He says, this is your monadic ray. There was a lady who was a six-ray soul, and she was transferring onto the second ray in her soul nature. Her rays were 6 and 1 and 1, 6, 1, 1, 6, 7, something like that. And, you know, so first ray personality, first ray mind. Her name was HSD. I forget what those initials stand for. But anyway, he says, you're a second ray monad. and you're making the transition off the sixth ray soul onto the second ray soul. There was another seventh ray soul person who he said to her, you are first ray monad. So in two cases, he actually laid it out. But in other cases, he gave so many hints that you could not escape the implication of what he was saying. And if you remember the principle that anybody who works with KH or DK for a long period of time and considers that line of instruction their major line of instruction, they have either a second ray soul or a second ray monad. So a number of these first ray souls who are just solidly in his group, you just know they had to have the second ray monad. Well, that was a little bit of a digression, but it comes in when we think about the way of higher evolution, which lies before the sixth degree initiate. Okay, note how this passage reverses the usual presentation. Hitherto, in occult books, the door of initiation has been presented as ever moving forward ahead of the initiate. I mean, we're always having the attitude of the individual or the group approaching the door of initiation. He passes through door after door into a wider experience and expansion of consciousness. And this is the aspirational, perhaps somewhat theosophical approach of the door of initiation looming ahead. But in the initiate consciousness, after the first two initiations, this is not the realization. Okay? It is simply the adhering to an old form of symbolism with the implied limitations of the truth. I would here remind you that the third initiation is regarded by the hierarchy as the first major initiation, and that the first and second initiations are simply initiations of the threshold. See, now, for a group like ours, it would only be meaningful to say, and we couldn't even say it yet, behind the group there stands the door, and we would have to mean the door to the second initiation. As a matter of fact, more realistically, we would have to say the door of the first initiation. That's where the majority of DK's students found themselves, at least having passed through the first initiation with the second initiation in sight. So that's the realism of it. But in this particular rule, he really does mean the third door. That's what lies behind him, them. This whole Rays and the Initiations book really begins at the third initiation, just the way a treatise on cosmic fire does. But we have to have something to aspire towards. So the first two initiations are simply considered initiations of the threshold. Whoops, what happened? Did I do something there? Did I eliminate something? Okay, no, not too bad. Okay, all right. For the bulk of humanity, these first two initiations will, for a very long time, constitute major initiatory experiences. I think he's saying, well, we have a relative situation here. Relatively, even though these are not major initiations, given where the bulk of humanity is, for them, they are major initiations, the first and second. The word major is very interesting because he tells us the hierarchy regards the third initiation as the first major. But then elsewhere, he describes all of the first five initiations as major when compared to certain earlier initiations, two of them specifically, which are minor initiations of humanity. One of them being taken when the third tier of petals in the egoic lotus opens up, and it's some kind of early form of group consciousness which is arising. It's a early and pre-monastic initiation. And there's another initiation when it is confirmed that an unselfish attitude is beginning to develop, and this is more around the fifth petal, somewhere in the fifth petal in that area, a minor initiation. I can show you what it is, but I don't want to get off the track. So, under those circumstances, he calls all the first five initiations major, even though from a higher perspective, only the third initiation is a real major initiation, because it is the first solar initiation. It's the first initiation that is part of the initiatory process of the solar logos and not just of the planetary logos. All right. But in a life, in the life and realization of the initiate soul, they are not. So the truly initiate soul is using the third initiation as the real beginning of solar life. After the two initiations of the threshold have been undergone, the attitude of the initiate changes. This is very important. After the second degree, there is a big shift in understanding and orientation. The attitude of the initiate changes, and he sees possibilities and factors and revelations which have hitherto been totally unrealized and unknown, even to his consciousness at his highest moments. And I would say around, if I may say, around the third degree, around the third degree. That's when a whole new life of being begins to come in, and things that he has not even suspected become part of his consciousness. And interestingly enough, DK is writing these books as if these things are becoming part of our consciousness. So we can always act as if. There's no problem with that. Okay. The door of initiation looms large in the consciousness of the neophyte. In other words, when you're a beginner, you're always thinking about getting initiated. That's what he's saying here. The higher way, which is the way of higher evolution, which begins at the sixth initiation, the higher way is the determining factor. Those are will words, right? Because we're talking about the will here. Only the will treads those higher paths. The monad treads those higher paths. The higher way is the determining factor in the life of the initiate of the third degree. From that time on, it is possible to become more cognizant of the higher way. So at the third degree, no, that's throat center, sorry, third degree, we become more cognizant of the possibilities of the way of higher evolution. But we certainly don't make a choice. You know, I have friends even now who have already decided what path they're going on. I don't know how they know that, because, you know, there are many initiations behind the sixth degree. So it'll be after we are a master that we really begin to shape up the possibility of what path we should be treading. Now, in a way, the decision is already made for you. It's a completely free choice, and yet the decision is made. In other words, there's only one correct path to take. But you get to choose to see whether you got the right one. It turns out the Buddha didn't choose properly. He wasn't supposed to, after his sixth initiation enlightenment, he wasn't supposed to tread the path of earth service. But, you know, love turned out to be an inhibiting factor. He loved humanity so much that he stayed with. You know how it is? second ray types are always staying with you, even after you don't want them anymore. But, of course, humanity wanted the Buddha. There's no question about that. In other words, they're so attached in a way. And so this is really so interesting. The Buddha's lesson, the Buddha's teaching is all about detachment. And then he stays with humanity for an extra 2,500 years. I find that to be an incredible irony, you know. But, you know, who is to pass judgment on that kind of consciousness? We can't. Okay. I thought I heard a dove. But it was just probably the back row. Okay. So anyway, the higher way is the determining factor in the life of the initiate of the third degree. I guess it means that this is the factor towards which This initiate, who is still treading the normal initiatory path, this is the factor which is the orienting factor for this type of initiate. It is the transfiguration. That's the name we know of the third degree. And a new glory pours through the transfigured initiate who has been released from every type of grip by either the personality or the soul.
Should we discriminate between the human soul and the spiritual soul at this point?
Okay, should we discriminate between the human soul and the spiritual soul? There's only one soul. There's only one center of consciousness. And if we call that center of consciousness a human soul, it means that that unit of being is immersed in a field of matter which limits its consciousness in a particular way. It's still the same soul. So the human soul is the unit of consciousness limited by the elemental vehicles. The soul on its own plane, the human ego, is that same unit of consciousness, far less limited. The ring pass knot of its consciousness is now consisting of the causal field with its higher vibratory constituents. The spiritual soul is that same unit of consciousness, only this time it has a planetary scope, because the matter that is limiting its consciousness is cosmic etheric matter and is by no means as encapsulated as the previous type of limitations. Then, when that is destroyed, it's still the same soul. It's still the same unit of consciousness, but this time far less limited, because it's focused on the sixth plane, the monadic plane, and has a huge extension of consciousness, and yet it's still the same unit, it's still the same monad, it's still the same soul. It's just that the ring pass knot has expanded. So at the transfiguration here, we are a jiva, we are an extension of the monad, we are focused on the higher mental plane. And we are able somehow to focus at will on the higher mental plane, and the sense of our identity and the scope of our being feels far less limited than it used to be when we were the human soul and could not get out of the lower worlds as limiters of our awareness. Now, there's more to it, of course, because in a way, there are multiple levels of consciousness which are all the same. In other words, what I'm saying is that right now, I am aware on the monadic plane, I am aware on the triadal plane, I am aware on the higher mental plane, and it's all the same I. It's all the same soul. So there is multidimensional consciousness going on simultaneously. It's just that you don't realize that until you have risen, until the lowest point of the jiva has risen along the line of consciousness to the next higher position. Then you realize that you were always consciousness, conscious in a place where you didn't know you were. So I think it's a very strange universe in a way. What I hint at, or what I think is true about this, is that right now I am conscious of the entire universe precisely and exactly at this moment. But who is the I? It is I, myself, but it's not the I seem to be. It's the I who is the one. And only later do we realize that all along we have been conscious of every single thing that's ever happened in our body of consciousness, which is the universe. Now, you know, in our little humble human position, that seems like an impossibility. Here we are, and this is it, and I only know this. But still, simultaneously, we are the one. And we have blinded ourselves at successive levels of immersion. And so there are kind of like, I have a special term for it in this Infinity book, and I call it dimensional sealing, S-E-A-L-I-N-G. And it great basically means that the lesser does not include the greater in its consciousness, but the greater does include the lesser. So we'll have quite a revelation later to realize that I, the one, have been active through every single emanation of myself, the tiniest atom, every individual, every form of life, every logos and galaxy. It's been only I all the time. And that will be one day realized. But right now, it's just a theory for us. What was your question? Yeah.
And the human soul is a blend of both.
It means simply that the monad, being put down in matter, is aware of its animal nature and aware of its human nature, and then it will add to that awareness of its higher mental nature. It's all the same awareness, and it's all the same unit of awareness.
But in many other instances, he does not specify what type of soul he needs, like in this.
Well, it is the transfiguration, and a new glory pours through the transfigured initiate who has been released from every grip by either the personality or the soul. And you say, is this perhaps the human soul? And I will say that it's the beginning of the release of the grip of that limited state of consciousness that occurs on the higher mental plane that we normally call the soul. In other words, we're getting ready for the fourth initiation here, and this is going to mean both soul and form together must renounce the principle of life and thus permit the monad to stand free. So most of us are not even yet soul controlled. Okay? We have a grip on our own personality, and we are making application to our higher self to control this personality. But we are not yet even the fully functioning soul on its own plane. Not yet. When we become initiates of the third degree, we will be the fully functioning soul on its own plane, preparing to relinquish those two gods. Remember yesterday from the old commentary? Those two gods die off, and a new god will take its place. And so neither the personality will control, because, you know, the third degree gives, release from the ancient authority of the threefold personality, something like that. And we will be preparing at the fourth degree to gain release from the authority of that dominating source that we have been calling the soul, which means the solar angel influencing the ego on the higher mental plane. That authority, too, will fade away, and a new authority will enter. That new authority is our own highest self, the monad, working through its personality, which is the threefold spiritual triad. The word glory is very important because, you know, we're supposed to move from glory to glory. It means the maximal radiant display of light, and not just of light, but maybe of love and power along with it. Whatever we've got here, there is a complete shining forth of it, so that it puts in a fantastic display for the inner eye, and our quality is not hidden under a bushel, but is as radiant as possible at that particular level of evolution. You know, now there are glories and glories and glories. You know, if you've ever been to a fireworks display, well, we have them on the 4th of July, and maybe you have some days when you have fireworks. I don't know. And you say, wow, look at that one. And then, oh, wow, look at that one. Oh, look at that one. And it keeps on getting bigger and bigger as the show goes on, because they save all the biggest fireworks for the end of the show. And this is a bit of a story about increasing glories, if you will. So the glory of the transfiguration is, well, when Jesus took his disciples, three of them, off into the desert, and then he was on the mountain and he was transfigured in front of them. Their eyes were blinded and they just went down onto the ground, which is the symbol of the three aspects of the personality bowing before the radiant soul. But that glory, as glorious as it was, is what compared to the fifth initiation or the sixth or beyond? So we have to get ready for ever larger demonstrations of light as our glory will increase. And the greatest of all supernovas, as it were, will be when the whole universe disappears into the absolute. That will be the maximal glory for our particular universe. But this is glorious enough, you know. Third degree is plenty glorious. It's okay. And we are looking forward to that particular glory. So a new glory, and there are many, pours through the transfigured initiate who has been released. And, you know, here I'm not exactly, the Tibetan says other things in other places. Yes, from every grip of the personality, but not yet from every grip of the soul. Except maybe later he subsides and goes back and, you know, can't quite live up to the initiation. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the story of the rich young man who went sadly away when invited by the Christ to follow him. He was still under the grip of his own soul. Is that comprehensible? He was rich in every way, full of understanding, knowledge, virtue, blah, 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 and he wouldn't give it up. Why? He liked it. You know, he really liked it. He was attached to that particular God who was his own higher ego. And the Christ principle says, I'm sorry, your higher ego is very nice, and you're only missing one thing. Just sell it all, give it to the poor, and follow me. That's a huge test in the life of the glorious ego. The rich young man who has a whole bunch of riches and is attached to them. So that's why DK has said other things in other places. I'm not saying he's incorrect here. I'm just saying he has given another perspective in different places. So, but anyway, for the first time, the goal of the higher way and the attainment of nirvana, as the Oriental calls it, appears before him, and he knows. Now, this is at the third degree. It's like, you know, at every degree, you're given a vision of what lies ahead, what you can achieve, and even what you can't achieve. It's a vision of what lies ahead. So this way of the higher is given to the third degree initiate. So it appears before him, and he knows that no forms and no spiritual complexes, that's kind of interesting, and no pull by either soul or form, or by both united, can have any effect upon his attaining his final destination. And in our morning meditation, what we did was, in a way, we presented seven options for a final destination, and you were asked to kind of like visualize those and make a commitment to follow one of those paths, or at least to follow one of them when the time comes, and to do everything you can right here and right now to work with continuity towards the inevitable following of one of those ways. Nirvana. Where is Nirvana? I know it sounds like a funny question, but let's find Nirvana. That's not Nirvana. Okay. Here, where is Nirvana? I've talked about this quite a bit. Nirvana is found somewhere on this map. Would you like to go there? Okay. That is not incorrect in a way. And it represents an even higher Nirvana than the first Nirvana. We're told that Nirvana is but the beginning of the endless way. And the Nirvana that the Buddha achieved, well, let's call it like this. This fifth plane is called the Nirvanic plane. The Atmic plane, identification with spiritual will, identification with the divine will, this is called the nirvanic plane. But you know, in a sense, I do agree with you that as a monad, he took the sixth initiation with a touch of the cosmic mental plane. And it seems to me that nirvana really belongs more appropriately to the monad than even to the atmic plane. Even though the atmic plane is called the nirvanic plane, I do agree that a fuller nirvana is found when you are a liberated monad. But the interesting thing about the Buddha, see, usually they just cut their ties and they go. The monad travels, as it were. That doesn't mean it moves through space. It just intensifies its point of tension, and that's travel. If you intensify your point of tension or de-intensify it, that's travel. But what the Buddha did was very interesting. He remained attached. And how do we know he remained attached, other than the fact that Master DK tells us that he chose the path of earth service, a completely free choice, which was not the right one for him. He saved his three higher vehicles. That's how we know he remained attached. Instead of cutting with them, and they would go through the usual destruction, just like the causal body goes through its destruction, he saved them. However he did this, you know, there must be inner means of doing such things. He saved them, so they remained in existence, and when it was time for the Christ to use them, 2,500 years later, they would be there and ready to go. There are storage places in the inner planes, you know. We're sometimes told that rods of initiation, this one is kept here, this one is hidden there. These great talismans, which give tremendous power, are concealed and guarded in certain places in the inner planes. So the Buddha, for 2,500 years, remained attached and is serving in Shambhala, still on the path of earth service. And for another 1,000, maybe 2,000 years, he will also be here with us. And later, at the end of the Aquarian Age, or after a good deal of it has passed, he and the Christ will pass before Sanat Kumara, I would say, to complete their seventh initiation. And then they will both pass on to other spheres of service. So the Buddha's connection with the earth has been tremendous. Very, very long, when he did not have to remain. And it's kind of interesting because he is a representation of the sign, what sign particularly? Taurus. And we are told that even though the earth is not the ruler of Taurus, that it has a very close connection with that particular constellation. Because of whom?
Venus.
Ah, okay. Okay, well, Gisler says because of Venus, that's the reason for Taurus, the Earth's association with Taurus, and that is one line of connection. I certainly agree from that point of view. I don't know, maybe there are other reasons too. They both share, you know, it's interesting that both the Earth and the sign Taurus share, if you will, earthiness or materiality or some kind of connection with the elemental worlds which are ruled by the moon. In other words, all these lower worlds of stuff that come from the previous solar system, the moon is their symbol. So the moon is exalted in Taurus, and the moon is a part of the Earth scheme. So it shows that there's an orientation towards materiality, both on our planet and even from a larger perspective within within the energy tendency of Taurus itself. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a very close connection between Taurus and the previous material solar system. I begin to get that idea that the matter part of Taurus connects with our previous solar system, which was very material in its nature. Okay, so anyway, we wake up to the fact at the third degree that nothing is going to stop us. My energy is great. My power is great. Nothing, I will destroy all obstacles. Nothing can stop my progress to my goal. So the will starts getting very strong at the third degree. All right. I would like for a moment to refer here to the door symbology as the initiate begins to grasp the inner meaning of these simple words. For long, the teaching given in the clear, cold light, okay, given in the light of the soul, or even more so, the pure light of reason, the teaching given in the clear, cold light anent the door, and the emphasis put upon the presentation of the door lying ahead of the aspirant has been familiar. We oftentimes do think of the door of initiation, don't we? I mean, that's a common symbol. And when we're in the Masonic Lodge, let us say, we knock on the door in order to be admitted. In other words, we signal somehow that we are approaching the inner sanctum. Even if aspirants did not realize it, they've been working with the lower aspect of the symbolism. That's what he's telling us here. They have been taught the fact of the light in the head. He did a lot of this in what book, teaching about the light in the head? You know it. White Magic. In the White Magic book, the light in the head, a lot. And elsewhere, but especially in the White Magic book. You've been taught about the light in the head, which is the personality correspondence to the clear, cold light to which I refer. And as a matter of fact, at a certain point of intuitive realization, the light in the head is strongly, strongly used, the area around the pineal gland, the head center. At the very center of that light, this is a piece of occultism, and it's very interesting. At the very center of that light, the light in the head, as many aspirants know theoretically or factually by inconstant experience, mean it sometimes happens for them, is a center or point of dark indigo blue, midnight blue. Now, when we do our full moon meditations, we talk about entering the blue sphere, the indigo sphere. That is a correspondence to, or at least it's a symbol that is related to, this indigo point of indigo light in the middle of in the head. Note the significance of this in view of what I have been saying about the dark night of the soul, the midnight hour, and the zero hour in the light of the soul. In other words, Jesus experienced the dark night of the soul, and a number of initiates do, and it means that somehow they're under the influence of this indigo sphere in the middle of the head, and they can see things the way they really are, and they realize how far man has been from God all these years. And the realization of the separation from the divine center, we read this yesterday, is for them an appalling realization. It's a horrible realization of how near and yet how far the divine center is for most people. So he's associating here this indigo center, the blue sun, as it were, with the dark night of the soul. And elsewhere he explains more about the dark night of the soul. And it's interesting, too, because it's not the dark night of the mind. He says that Master Jesus upon the cross, incredible realizations impressed his soul and not his mind. So there is the distinction here. It's a higher and wider type of mind. That center is in reality an opening, a door leading somewhere, a way of escape, a place through which the soul imprisoned in the body can emerge and pass into higher states of consciousness, untrammeled, which means, you know, not confined by form limitations. So I think that's really worth looking at again here. That central point in the head, and, you know, sometimes in other teachings they call it the cave and so forth. That center is in reality an opening, a door leading somewhere, a way of escape, just like the Antikorana is a way of escape, a place through which the soul imprisoned in the body can emerge and pass into higher states of consciousness untrammeled by form limitations. So that exists for every one of us, and one day we learn how to pass through that indigo door in the center of the light, which is revealed in the etheric brain around the pineal gland. Let's just for a moment just focus within the center of the etheric head as if that indigo center really does exist. We will use our imagination. So we have to learn the reality of this vortex or funnel or tunnel and learn how to use that. You know, you kind of think about the tunnel of light also, which the near-death experience people talk about. There are various exits from the form, mostly until the etheric web on the top of the head is burned away. Our consciousness is pretty much trapped in the form, but in the old Atlantean days, I guess the etheric web around the solar plexus was quite burned away because people were going in and out of their body all the time, and the astral plane was a great place of escape. So in the Aryan age, that has been sealed a bit. We're supposed to stick with it and mind the business of our task. But there are other exits. You were mentioning them the other day, the heart area. You can escape through that area and also then through the top of the head. And it seems that this indigo sphere in the center of the head is related to that type of escape, but it's more to be used by the initiate for particular travel to other dimensions while keeping the link with this body. And of course it's very interesting because it's connected with the blue eye, isn't it? The eye of Shiva, and it's connected with the blue logos, isn't it? Somehow we're all part of the blue logos. We don't know what color blue our logos is, but indigo is a pretty good bet. So anyway, there's a psychic exit here in the center of the head. It has also been called the funnel or the channel for the sound. And, you know, it's very interesting when the soul says to its instrument, I draw the essence back, as it were. When the soul says it's time to die, the soul sounds a word, and then the principle of mind then repeats that word. And then the waiting form responds and falls away. There's a sound of the soul, the word of death, that can come through into the personality life. And there are probably many other sounds as well that the still small voice can speak. So there is a sound connection here between the soul on its own plane and the personality, and it looks like this central point of the head is used as a means of communication. The philosopher Descartes felt that he had found the location of the soul, okay? And he said, it is the pineal gland. And the pineal gland is, for most of us, not yet fully vitalized. It has been atrophied over many, many millions of years, and it's now regaining its power in the life of the progressing disciple and aspirant. So this activation of this area of the brain, the pineal gland, the etheric area around it, which forms the light in the head, which condenses to the image of a blazing sun, and in the center of that blazing sun is found the indigo disc, which is the funnel or the channel of coming and going, deliberately so. So this is a piece of occultism, and probably we're going to have to work with this, I would say. Yeah, Lena? Yeah, yeah, that's what I was saying. I say there are many other kinds of sounds that can come through, of course, because the ego is in touch with its personality via sound. AUM? Mm-hmm. I do have some thoughts about that, and of course, you know, the whole idea of the voice of the silence is pretty much about the word of the soul. It's a means of communication between the solar angel underlying the ego and its personality. But DK, in the Raisin, the initiations, which you're probably aware of, deals with the AUM, the OM, and the O. And there are two ways of interpreting the AUM. It depends on whether it's A period, U period, M period, or AUM without dots. And from one perspective, he wants us to discontinue the use of the AUM in favor of the OM, because he describes it as the word of the third aspect, which pins a man into matter and does not let him release. So he says that in the future, in the churches, the use of the word Amen will be discouraged because it will be seen as a materially anchoring word. Now, having said that, it's also obvious that the AUM has a higher meaning and is related to the three higher planes. The A is the logoic sound. The AU is the monadic sound, also equivalent as in French to the word O. And the AUM is the atmic sound. So he presents a kind of a higher interpretation of the AUM rather than just as a word which should give way to the OM. But he does seem to say that we should use the OM extensively now rather than playing with the AUM, because it is the word of the soul and it is the word that brings empowerment to the soul and release to the soul. So I think there is some research to be done around the two ways of interpreting AUM. And I think that the word of the soul that's usually used by the soul is more the OM. But, you know, this gets a little bit complicated, because sometimes he tells us that even OM is not the real word of the soul, but just a symbolic word for the true word of the soul. Elsewhere, he seems to suggest that the real word of the spirit is the O, without the addition of the M. So that is the word of the monad. But I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up telling us that that also is a symbolic word, and that the true words are other. So I agree with you that it's not just about death. This funnel for the sound can be all about high forms of communication between the soul and the personality. But I think we have to be cautious about the use of the AUM because of what he says about its material potential. And we'll get to that part in the book where he discusses that. Okay, so anyway, the funnel or the channel for the sound. It has been named the trumpet through which the escaping AUM can pass. And this is, in other words, the spirit has been pinned in matter. Even AUM as a word is the atmic word. The Shivic word is A, the monadic word is AU. The atmic word is the beginning of Brahma. Fivefold Brahma. And Brahma is the third being who presides over the third aspect of divinity. So whatever is like him is buried in matter. I simplify the matter, but that which is of Brahma is buried in form. And so that's why he refers to here the escaping AUM. It is the spirit that has been buried in fivefold form, and it is now ready to go off through into the higher planes. So sometimes we hear about the five worlds of superhuman evolution. Here, I'll show you what I mean on the map. It's pretty obvious, but let's just say that my computer may be protesting. It hasn't been cleaned for quite a while, so it may be refusing to show me what I want. You see, it's trembling, it's quivering. Can't believe it. There we go. All right. Brahma are these five worlds. The A is found here, the AU is found here, and the AUM is found here. It's the word that governs the number five. Five is the number of the previous solar system, just like seven is the number of our solar system. It's a monastic number, manas. So AUM is a monastic word, and it's an exoteric word from one perspective. Okay, from one perspective. AUM is an exoteric word because exotericism has to do with the five lower planes, and esotericism begins with the monad and the logoic plane. These are the two esoteric planes. The five planes below are exoteric, and they are under the control of Brahma. So we have to be very careful that we don't trap ourselves in the world of Brahma. We're already trapped, but we have to escape the world that has been given to us by the previous solar system, and we have to escape into our present solar system, which emphasizes the second aspect of divinity. Now, you know, I don't know every last word about the word, but I'm just assembling for you basically what he said about the AUM and the OM. So it's also been called the trumpet. It's a reverse funnel through which the escaping AUM can pass, the imprisoned word of the soul. Let's just say that, you know, the word is lost. It's the old story in Masonry, you go in search of the lost word. That's the whole thing about the Masonic quest. Where is the word lost? It's lost in the realms of matter. It is buried in Brahma. It's buried in the five lower planes. That word has to be found again and restored to its own true place, which is on the esoteric planes. This could get pretty involved. I don't want to get into it too much, but suffice it to say that in the lower worlds where we human beings live, the three lower worlds are the lower correspondence to the five lower planes. Like from a cosmic perspective, Brahma is fivefold. From the human perspective, Brahma is found way down here. And the next stop, when you go into the golden flower, that's already Vishnu. But from the bigger perspective, Vishnu is found on the monadic plane. And then eventually we have to reach Shiva, which in a way begins microcosmically with the entrance into the spiritual triad, which leads straight to the top part of the monad. But of course, these are just words, and what's important is that we begin an experience of some of these higher states. Because if our words don't lead eventually to experience, then they just are words, and they don't open the door to real living, you might say. So interesting what this central vortex is called, this indigo eye, this indigo entrance to a cave. It's called the funnel, it's called the trumpet, it's called the cave, it's called the indigo sun, and it is an anatomical part of our structure. So one day we have to learn how to use that to achieve greater freedom. The ability to use this door or channel is brought about by the practice of alignment. Well, that ought to be quite an incentive, don't you think? Hence the emphasis laid upon this exercise in the attempt to train aspirants and disciples. So, you know, why bother to be aligned? Alignment is the beginning, alignment is the end. So, the right practice of alignment, and especially, you know, in the Dynatu book, we have practiced it before, the third meditation is all about alignment, all the way from the foundation in the personality all the way to the monad. It's a fantastic alignment exercise. And basically, DK looked at his group after giving them the first two meditations in Dynatu, and he said, "You need alignment." So he interrupted for a moment the process that he was moving with, and he gave them this alignment exercise to make sure that their work would be more effective. And we could and should practice this. We do this in the Mori Federation. We have this practice, but I'm sure you've used it too. You know the one I mean. It's a very simple exercise. It's just about half a page long, but it leads all the way to the top of our energy system. Okay. All right. Now, once alignment has been achieved, it will be realized, remembering the symbolism of the head, the light, and the central opening, that's another thing it's called, that many occasions arise. Okay, now he's going to give the occult definition of behind the group there stands the door. Okay, many occasions arise in meditation when behind the group there stands the door, before them opens out the way. This is the lower correspondence of the higher initiate experience to which our rule is, with which our rule is dealing. In other words, this is a door. The door of initiation, he's saying, has a lower correspondence, and that lower correspondence is the indigo sphere, the central opening in our head. And basically, he's saying when we meditate, we oftentimes pass through that indigo door, even though we might not know it, and then behind the meditator, there stands the door. And this is a lower correspondence to that higher correspondence, that higher aspect of it that relates to the initiate. What would be the door of the that opens into the third initiation? What would be that door? Where would that door be found? Because in a way, the door we're speaking of right now, the indigo door, is found down here on the etheric level. And so in a way, that door could even exist on the fourth ether, the fourth systemic ether. But there is a door of initiation. Where will this door be found so that we can say, behind the group there stands the door? Where will this door be found? Do we have an idea? Or a speculation? A thought? It's not down here anymore, is it? I believe that is correct. I believe that this door is found in relation to the dotted line on the mental plane. That mostly we would be confined to what we call the concrete mind, and we're working in the mind. But I believe that there is a door, or, you know, an energy field or a barrier, however you want to define the word door, which allows conscious entry into the causal body. And that any initiate of the third degree must achieve at will conscious entry into the causal body, and that's the door. I believe that at the fourth initiation, the door is found between the highest part of the mental plane, which is the first subplane. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to make this bigger. That the door will be found at the fourth initiation right here. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay. I know what you're speaking about. The monad on the third ray has a particular location, but that's on the monadic plane. It's on the third subplane of the monadic plane, and it has to repolarize on the second subplane of the monadic plane. See, in other words, a lot of people today, not all, okay, but a lot of people today who are in line for achievement, and by achievement we mean the fourth degree, are third ray monads coming from the moon chain, with a lot of experience and so forth. These monads, and there may be more of them now than later, are focused on the monadic plane somewhat below the second ray monads and first ray monads. But this is the second ray solar system. So these monads have to find the way, and who knows what that way is, to basically refocus on the second subplane of the monadic plane, because now they're on the third. This might have a higher mental correspondence as well, but generally speaking, it doesn't make any difference what monad or soul ray you are. If you are an initiate of the first degree, you're going to be on the second subplane of the mental plane. The majority of people are on this third subplane of the mental plane before they wake up. And do you see the correspondence again? They are exoteric. There are five subplanes below them. Five is the exoteric Brahmic number. The minute they become esoteric, which means that they move into the initiatory stream, they focus in the first of the esoteric ethers on the mental plane, which is the second ether. It's the second esoteric ether. Okay. This is the first esoteric ether. But they focus here. When they're going for the fourth initiation, they make the transition so they wake up with their consciousness polarized here. When they go for the fifth initiation, there is a Buddhic focus of the fourth degree initiate. Now, I'm not necessarily saying, you know, it's complicated, but suffice it to say that even masters don't really have all of the powers available to them of the two highest levels of the Buddhic plane. You have to be a Chohan or a Chohan of the seventh degree. But suffice it to say, they learn how to make the transition from the Buddhic plane onto the Atmic. That's where the door leads to. The door between the fourth and fifth initiation leads to the Atmic plane. And on we go. There are even in some diagrams a picture of a kind of causal body that is found on the higher levels of the Atmic plane. And when it comes time for the sixth initiation, the implication is that this body is destroyed and the consciousness is liberated onto the monadic level, hence another door. So the doors are always with us, and the key thing about it is we have to show that our vibration, as we stand before the door, as we learned yesterday, we have to show that our vibration is the same as that which is on the further side of the door. And when we have demonstrated that our vibration is the same as on the other side of the door disappears, and we can pass through. And all of this will probably have to be defined in terms of electricity, because the door is an electrical barrier. And then it is neutralized as a barrier when on both sides of the door there is the same type of vibration.
Are you saying that the focus of the first three initiations are at the upper three levels of the mental plane?
All of the first initiations are taken in the causal body. So, and as a matter of fact, the first three initiations, as far as I know, are taken on the second level of the causal body. In other words, number two. But there are lower correspondences at each one of these initiations which involve etheric functionality, astral functionality, and mental functionality. So the initiation itself, he tells us, is always taken here. But there are sympathetic responses that occur below at the progressive levels, etheric, astral, mental, that allow greater capacity in each one of those areas following the event which occurs inside the causal body. You always meet the initiator in the chamber of initiation, and it's always the causal body until, well, as a matter of fact, for the first three initiations, it's always the causal body. At the fourth initiation, this is my guess, the initiation begins in the causal body and ends with the causal body destroyed. And then you will be standing for the first time not just receiving buddhi, but actually polarized on the buddhic plane. The question was?
Well, if I remember correctly, you suggested that the focus of each of the three first initiations correspond to the upper three planes of the mental plane.
Oh, in a way. In a way. The first initiation allows you to move your causal body, to move from the third level of the mental plane to the second. However, it's not quite so simple, because even advanced people who are approaching the first initiation, what we call advanced man, is already lifting that focus onto the second level. But by the time the first initiation comes, the focus of the ego on the third level of the mental plane definitely shifts to the second. In the second initiation, the focus remains precisely on the second level. At the third initiation, although the causal body does not change position, a line of rapport with the monastic permanent atom is strengthened and reinforced, linking the monastic permanent atom and the mental petals of the egoic lotus. So that characteristically, the third degree initiate is able to focus himself in the abstract mind. But the causal body doesn't change position. Now, some people have just gone ahead with the inference that at the third degree, the causal body moves up to the first level, and DK absolutely contradicts that. He just says it stays on the second level until it is destroyed. But the consciousness of the initiate can focus within the causal body at will and within the abstract mind at will. But it cannot yet focus on the Buddhic plane at will. It is still confined to the higher mental plane. When the fourth initiation occurs, the causal body is destroyed, and the consciousness of the initiate is now polarized on the Buddhic level, and the abstract mind can still be used, but it is not the preferred point. It is simply a point of creativity, because they have immediate intuitive consciousness, and they can use the abstract mind to build something to relate to the lower worlds. Meanwhile, on the lower planes, there are reciprocal activities which occur because of the emphasis of the first, second, and third, or third, second, and first aspect within the causal body. So, you know, whether the first initiation begins on the third level and ends up on the second, who's to say? I think it all takes place at that point on the second level. That is my impression. That the causal body of even the first degree initiate is right on that second level, because it corresponds to Buddhi, and initiation is the beginning of Buddhi coming into the consciousness. It is the Christ aspect. For 25 million years, though, or 20 million years, whatever, the causal body has been on the third sublevel of the mental plane, and there has been no causal consciousness except between lives. And even then, if you're a primitive man, you hardly know what's going on as far as that goes. You may be withdrawn into the causal body very, very rapidly and then descend. It's not like real experience. Okay, we have two questions here. Remember from Cosmic Fire, the monadic? Monadic? Which permanent atom? Monastic permanent atom. Monastic permanent atom, yes? So if you say the third degree, third ray monads have difficulty taking what initiation? To take? Okay, well, you'd have to find the reference for me. You know, now we need specifics. He does say this, the third and fifth ray people, the i.e. souls, can take the second degree much easier. This is a little different, but it's along that line. They can take the second degree much easier than the 2-4-6 line, or even Ray 1. So in terms of ease of initiation, you'd have to find me the reference so I can understand and interpret it. If you can find it, I'm willing to look. Your main point is, however, I know what you're talking about. The different qualities of the monadic ray affect the ease with which certain initiations may be taken or certain points in a triangle emphasized. Here is one related thought. It's about opening the petals of the egoic lotus. He says that the knowledge petals are always the first to open, but the second ray monad will open the love petals almost as rapidly. See, this is very interesting. It is most difficult for the first ray types to open the love petals. It is most difficult for the second ray types to open the knowledge petals, and this is according to the monadic ray, even though the knowledge petals open the fastest for all in general, but it's most difficult for the second ray types to open the knowledge petals, the first ray types to open the love petals, and the third ray types to open the will petals. And so you see in the chakra system various imbalances due to the monadic ray and the speed of stimulation that occurs because of the monadic ray. Every triangle in the etheric system has a first, second, and third ray point. And the triangle will get filled out rapidly or slowly according to the monadic ray. This is called geometrical progression. The fire has to progress in a geometrical manner, and it will be controlled by what is the ray of the monad, because there's different speeds of activation according to the monadic ray. Now, he did say at one point, discussing the first ray monads, they have the greatest problem learning love. I'll try to find the reference that I'm talking about, because this is the only one I can remember where opening of some center or some petal is related to the quality of the monadic ray. If you want to discuss this in the break, we can do that. Okay, well, look, it is 11:03. Therefore, it's time to have a short break. So we'll see you in 15 minutes. Okay. Okay, everybody, we seem to be into something that is interesting people. We'll be back in 15 minutes, and this is provoking a lot of questions, so we'll do the best we can with that.